Who are you?
My name is Cabot.
Cabot?
Cabot!
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 Cabot?
Nope, doesn't ring a bell.
Hey, everybody.
Hello.
It's time for Outlaw of Gore.
Outlaw of Gore.
It's sometimes known as Outlaw.
Yeah, we're never going to figure that out, I don't think.
You know, Jason, you can catch more slaves with honey than with vinegar. That's what I've learned from today's episode.
Yeah, it's true.
Also, sometimes if you go to your... If you go to a bar with your best friend, then yeah. He puts on a ring and you end up in a magical dimension.
Yeah.
Sand.
Yeah. If his ring starts glowing,
yeah,
you will be a going
right
to Gore.
And then you get to be a consort and then they throw you in prison.
Yeah.
And then there's a midget for really no terribly good reason.
Yeah.
Or a small person. Sorry.
Yeah. I love this movie.
I know you do.
Yeah. I really like it.
I mean, I really thought it was good, but I don't think I quite got the... I don't think I got the gore fever the way that you did.
Oh, man. It's the something about the two doofy sidekicks. One of them is like the normal human sidekick.
What's
and
his
one
name?
Of them
like
is the midget.
Winston or?
Like Walsey or?
Yeah, something like that. So wait. Full disclosure, we didn't watch this right before we recorded today. We watched it a couple days ago. But
yeah. I've seen it a few times. It's one of the ones that gets replayed a lot on like... the YouTube channel and on like, I don't know if there's a place where they've rated Mystery Science Theater episodes like we're doing, but I bet in aggregate, it's probably like top 20, top 30 episodes of classic MST.
I think that's true. I think if they did like a classic Turkey Day marathon, this would probably be included.
Be up there. Yeah.
And it's definitely a great one. It's one of the ones I could imagine putting on to go to sleep for sure. Cause it's got this kind of lulling rhythm. I mean, the beginning is random and chaotic and insane, but then after they actually get to the planet, it kind of slows down actually a lot.
Yeah.
It's one of those movies where a lot of things are happening and yet nothing is happening at the same time. Like you could leave the room for a few minutes and come back and be like, what did I miss? And it'd be like,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. No, it doesn't matter. Although we did notice and give credit to the fact that on multiple occasions that it has very good production values, like it's well set, choreographed, like it looks good sometimes.
Yeah, and they chose a lot of really interesting sets, like physical sets that they had to travel to, like travel sets.
I really liked the giant. They show it a couple times, like when the queen mm-hmm. is sitting on her throne outside.
Right.
And it's like the front of the city.
Yeah.
I was like, man, they spent a lot of time on that set.
Yeah. Well, and then they have that whole Indiana Jones thing where the guy's riding the horse and sets all the tents on fire.
Right.
I mean, that stuff's not cheap or easy to do.
Yeah. Lots of extras too. Like some scenes with like 50 people at a time. And I was like, okay, you had to pay those people.
And I will say it's not a gray man in a gray room doing nothing movie. I mean, stuff happens.
Yeah. It's exciting.
This guy gets kidnapped.
Yeah. And there's choreography. There's fight choreography. There's duels. There's horse riding.
Yeah.
I don't know what else.
It suffers from a few basic problems. One of which is that it doesn't make a damn bit of sense, any of it. And then also, it has that quality where the leading man is just not leading man enough at all. It reminds me of Time Chasers. Is it Time Chasers when Crow is like, I don't accept this.
As our hero, yeah. Well, he's a lot less doofy than the Time Chasers. He at least looks like a hero. He just doesn't sound or act like one.
Is he a lot less doofy? I mean, he's like...
Oh, yeah, because he's actually like muscly and attractive. The guy in Time Chasers is wormy and skinny and pale and pasty and, you know.
But the dude in this movie is a vegetarian.
Yeah, I know. Why did they put that detail in?
I don't know.
We were so taken aback by it. It was like jarring. It was like, wait, why does he says it like 45 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
I'm a vegetarian.
Right.
It's like, really? Like, why do we have this detail?
And the one time they send the hunter after him, he immediately gets captured because he falls asleep and the guide basically just captures him.
Yeah. He's pretty inept, but I'm just saying he does look like he worked out in the gym.
Maybe. He looks very, he doesn't look like Conan though. He looks like Jim Bro.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's so polished and kind of pasty.
Yeah. Yeah.
He doesn't look like he ever went outside.
Yeah. Well, he's like stock white guy too. He's very uninteresting.
And then the movie uses all the same tricks as Star Trek. I mean, I think it literally uses a lot of the same parks and like scenes, those ones down in Southern California. At least it feels that way.
For desert stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even for the non-desert scenes.
Yeah.
Although we decided it was shot somewhere else, right? Like Italy or somewhere. Didn't we look it up or something?
I don't remember. Am I wrong? Possibly.
Do you remember the last scene of the movie? And then Crow and Tom Sover are like, well, this is interesting wherever we are. Because you can't tell where they are, right? It looks like a city.
Well, they also did very glaring use of a combination of like authentic like desert and then suddenly... Like, because they had to change the time of day or something. Like, there's a scene where they're camping in the desert and it's night. And it's so obviously a very cheap, like, Star Trek style soundstage with, yeah, like, plastic rocks.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a minute. Like, this looked so good a minute ago. Like, what happened to this movie? It was kind of like the thing of, like, we were saying, like, you'd go to the bathroom and you'd leave a scene in a desert and you'd be like, wow, this looks kind of Arabian Nights and kind of cool. And you come back and it would be like the soundstage. And you'd be like, it's a totally different movie. Like, it looks like a different movie.
Yeah.
It's lit differently. It's just like, you know.
Yeah. And we haven't even talked yet about Jack Palance.
Oh man, I think that's what throws it over for me. It's like, first of all, Jack Palance just in general is just funny for some reason. There's just something about him. Like, we took him seriously in the 80s, you know? And now when we look back on it, we're like, that hasn't aged well, like that character type. Then it's the fact that they make such relentless fun of him, the Mystery Science Theater guys. They're just right on top of him the whole time.
Can you do a Jack Palance impression? I don't think I could do Jack Palance.
Well, what is like Mike? God, what were some
mine
of the
always
jokes?
Comes out more like Jack Nicholson. You know, you're my number one.
guy. Yeah, yeah. Well, that actually is Jack Palance in the original Batman movie that does that before the Joker.
I know,
Joker
you told me
it.
That.
Yeah. But yeah, no, Mike is always like, oh, well, they do the skit where they read his diary of making the movie. Like,
right.
Yeah. Day 5, missed call. Hung out with a tiny midget guy. Weird dude. Yeah, like, that was great. I love that stuff. The skits in this episode were fantastic.
Yeah.
I love, and we'll go back to the movie, but just like the Mads, Dr. Forrester has built quote unquote a time machine.
And
it basically just, you realize after a minute that he's just trying for whatever reason to fool like Mike into thinking he has a time machine.
Yeah.
So he's just built like basically a set.
Yeah.
And then he puts Frank behind it and then they come out and like Frank biffs it like he's supposed to be a caveman and he comes out in his Roman uniform instead.
Yeah.
And Dr. Forrester gets really mad.
Yeah.
And then tries to recover it. And it's just like, and it's the absurdity of like, why are they trying to impress Mike?
Yeah. It's got that classic energy. He's like, boy, we sure are in the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, look at all these 60s things.
Look
that
at
are
the
happening.
Flower children. Yeah. Now we're in the 20s.
Yeah.
Oh, the roaring 20s.
Yeah.
Is that Calvin Coolidge? It's just like, yeah, it doesn't, it's so bad. It's, yeah. But I think what they're doing almost is like an essay on like, that's how it sometimes feels to watch these movies.
Right.
You sort of feel like, oh, I'm almost kind of watching a facsimile of something that's a movie. You
yeah.
Know?
Uh-huh.
But it's not. But
right.
But if I squint my eyes, like, oh, look, there it is.
Yeah. Boy, we sure are in the desert.
Yeah.
It's so sandy and hot in this desert. Yeah. No, it's true.
It's like when Mike makes his, like, character, his he tries to escape Hobgoblins in the Hobgoblins episode.
With
and
the
he
cardboard.
Builds his wooden cardboard cutouts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. He's like, wow, that sure is a crazy thing in that movie. Look at that guy.
What's happening with this guy over here?
Yeah. Look at that doodad. Yeah.
Yeah. And okay. Of course, his name is Cabot.
Oh, yes. Which we only know because his Watley.
Watley.
Watley. The sidekick. The reason we don't remember Watley's name is because nobody ever says Watley's name, but Watley constantly is just...
Well,
saying Cabot's name over and over
again. And then later in the movie, for no good reason, his role is taken over by the short guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Who walks around saying Cabot
right.
for a while.
So Whatley betrays Cabot which, and ends up in prison.
Can we just cover something briefly?
Yeah.
Who is that guy? The short guy? Fictionally in the movie.
Well, we never looked it up, but we think that this might be a sequel.
Right.
Yeah, and that maybe if we had watched the first one,
it would have made more sense.
Yeah, because remember there's that weird, awkward montage where they go through events that happened in the past for a minute.
I don't.
It happens early in the film.
I believe you.
And it's supposed to catch us up to the goings-on of Gore.
Man, so the first movie did well enough that they made a sequel?
Well, remember, a movie doesn't have to do well just to make a sequel. Some people just do it anyway.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe it did. Maybe the first movie's way better. You know, a lot of times sequels are way shittier than the first one. Maybe we're watching the shitty sequel.
So is this a Mortal Kombat situation where nobody thought it would be good and then it turned out it was good and then they were like, we have to make a sequel? Could be.
Maybe they recast some of these people.
Yeah.
Maybe they had better actors.
We should look it up.
Yeah. Be an interesting follow-up. Maybe we need to have a mini episode later of the podcast where we go and watch Outlaw One just to see if it's any better.
So one of my notes about this movie, I did like the movie. I'm not trying to dump on it. It's funny, it's fun, it's wacky, it's goofy. But one of the things that really struck me, I mean, we both noticed it, is the movie just lingers on some really weird directorial choices.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that might have been interesting as kind of a really brief note, but they linger on them. That super weird scene where there's all the slavers and they're kidnapping all the people.
Yes.
But it just goes on and it's very graphic.
Yeah. You know what my impression of that was? Is that so I think they hired a ton of extras, good on them, and they got that desert scene. And then they had no good choreographers, so they just said, run around. You're the people that are whipping those people, so just chase them around in circles.
Right.
And they probably figured that would look good for a few seconds at a time. But then, you know how films ostensibly have a separate editor? Assume for the moment that there's an editor for this film.
Right.
I think the editor just left it all in.
Well, no, that's exactly.
I think they filmed 7 minutes of it,
yeah.
And the editor was like, this is gold.
Yeah.
Let's just run it.
No, I think you're exactly right. That scene is the kind of scene that even a good movie might film wondering what it would look like, because why not? We'll just film this all.
Yeah.
But then that's supposed to get cut.
Yeah. Or it's used a couple seconds at a time. Like you see 5 seconds of one guy chasing a guy.
Right.
And then it cuts back to the heroes.
Yeah.
What this didn't do is it didn't cut. It just showed it. It just played the whole footage.
Right.
And it was zoomed out. So you saw all of the extras at once and they're just literally going in a circle.
Right. Yes. Yes. And also, so not only is it a weird editorial choice, but also my other point about the weird thing is the things that they linger on are weird. There's this super weird femsploitation fight scene where they're barely clothed and wrestling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a really weird whipping scene where they whip Cabot.
Yeah, I remember that.
Very graphically, for a long time. And then there's that weird scene where they're selling the slaves, including the woman.
Yep.
And they really linger on the misogyny and the, it's this is what you want to linger on in your movie? Why are we watching this? This is so crass and kind of...
Well, there was clearly a part of this was definitely, and it's one of the reasons why the Mike and the Bots did a skit. Actually, they did two skits. One was a song.
Yeah.
And then I think they went back to it specifically about... Yeah, because they do the Tubular Boobular
song,
which we have to talk about.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And then later they do the skit where they're just showing all the, what they call the buffalo shots.
The buffalo shots, yeah.
And the reason they spent so much time on that is to basically acknowledge that a big part of this movie was obviously supposed to be sort of sex appeal, general, look at all these naked bodies, sexy naked ladies and naked men.
Right.
That's a piece of why this movie exists.
No, I get that. But I'm comparing our leading man to Arnold Schwarzenegger and it's not working out for me.
I remember him being sort of good looking.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not Arnold Schwarzenegger buff, but I think he's attractive. I definitely think there's a big gap between him and like the Time Chasers guy.
I mean, if you wanted some 80s, you know, you wanted to meet your 80s softcore porn, you know, Skinamax late at night quota, I don't think this is the one I would pick, right?
I thought he was pretty handsome. I think my main guff with him is that he just didn't have the voice for it. Like his voice was very like dainty. It's like when they, you know, like Brock Lesnar is like an MMA WWE guy, and like they rarely have him talk on camera. They usually get like a manager to talk for him because he's this huge hulking, like he looks like he could, you know, tear your head off. But then when he talks, it's kind of like me, Brock Lesnar. And so you're like, ooh, like get the mic away from that guy, right? I think like if I had money and time, I would have overdubbed this guy or something. I would have gotten, you know, like they did with Darth Vader. Like I just would have cut the original voice out and found like a James Earl Jonesy deep, like I am the outlaw, you know, to like do his voice, right? It would have been way better. But instead you get this kind of schmarmy, like, ooh, Cabot, you know, like it's not compelling.
Yeah. So we have to talk about it, breasticle mammicle.
Right. And so that's another reason why. So that's another reason why this episode, it's kind of like when you can't help but like love an album, like a musical album just for one track.
Yeah.
This episode, I love it. If nothing else, just for Tubular Boobular Joy. It is maybe the best song, in my opinion, they ever made.
Yeah.
On Mystery Science
Theater. It's got to be top three.
It's so intricate. And it goes really fast. So it's one of those things where if you don't think about it, you're like, oh, that was pretty good. But if you think about all the lines, it's like, wow, they really packed a lot of writing into this song.
I think that's just all Kevin Murphy.
Yeah. I think him and Mike were the two music guys. And I think,
what's the one that they wrote? I'm trying to think of the Kevin Murphy song.
In Mystery Science Theater?
I think it might have been after Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, like a Riff Tracks?
Yeah.
Yeah, they did do a few songs for Riff Tracks too.
And it's really good and it's long.
He can't help himself because he's not only is he, so Mike is very musical, but Kevin is a singer. Like he has a really good singing voice. So right. I think he just really enjoys the craft of singing.
Yeah.
And you can feel it in Tubular Boobular Joy. Like the parts where Tom is singing, he's so enthusiastic. It's just, it's over the top levels of enthusiasm.
Right. So there's been this whole thing on r/MST3K lately. Not to get political, but like the Trump Freedom 250 concert, you know, and then pulled out. Yeah. There's been this whole meme going around where they just show like musical groups from Mystery Science Theater 3000, like the Tom Servo All Men's
choir of like 20 times.
And then the caption will be something about how they've pulled out of the Freedom 250 concert.
That's great.
But it's been interesting because it's like a run through of all of the musical acts that either were featured in a movie on Mystery Science Theater or were in one of the skits. That Tom Servo Men's choir thing. I don't even remember what that skit is about, but I just remember all the Tom Servos lined up.
Well,
I
remember there's a really intricate, and I'm sure we'll get to it. And this is also this might also be a 10 out of 10, The Quest of the Delta Knights. Because I like, you know, I'm really kind of a sucker for these schmaltzy, what do you call them, Wizards and Warriors kind of.
Yeah.
What do they call Renfest style movies?
Yeah.
Especially when they're from like the 70s and 80s. Yeah. But he does like an ode to the Delta Knights. Uh-huh. And it's like a literal full a cappella song. It's just him layered like four or five times, like a barbershop quartet of just Kevin Murphy.
Yeah.
And they play it as like, they play it as like, at some point they decided Tom Servo clones himself randomly all the time. Right. I don't remember when that started, but like somewhere back in the early seasons. And so he just has like 20 of them and they're all singing in an a cappella choir. And it is like the most detailed, intricate musical work. It's really impressive, especially considering you've seen interviews with these guys and you know how little time they sometimes had to like craft an episode. Like they were spitting this shit out, like, you know, they were turning this stuff around fast.
Yeah.
And like for him to divert into these musical, it's like not easy to write a funny song and then to like score it and put music to it and layer yourself multiple times. Like, it's very, I'm very impressed with them when they do this shit. I think Tubular Boobular Joy is a tremendous work of art. I really do. I think it's gorgeous.
Yeah, it's really catchy.
So we should say for people who are listening, if they don't know it, first of all, go watch it immediately on YouTube. If you haven't, it's okay if you don't want to watch the whole Outlaw of Gore, but go and look up Tubular Boobular Joy.
Yeah.
That's the name of the song.
Right.
And it's just basically a giant, it starts with, I think, Mike saying, gee, there sure is a lot of skin in this movie.
Yeah.
And then they erupt into what I can only describe as a vaudeville like carnival ride, barbershop quartet style rounds song.
Yeah.
Just really up-tempo, very 1950s.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. And half of the words in the song are like not quite words, but they're constructions of words to describe like nudity basically and sexual gratuity.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great.
Exposula regional.
Yeah. Yeah. Fruit of the Lumular. Yeah. You gotta see it. And it takes you 20 times to really appreciate it. Like I've heard that song a lot. And every time I hear it, I still laugh. Like I'm still laughing at each time. I mean, that's how good the comedy is.
Yeah, it's very tightly constructed.
Gee, guys, there sure is a lot of skin in this movie.
Why, there sure is.
I just can't come up with a word that describes it. I mean, like, it's burned into my brain. It's a culture classic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they have that what's the guy with the big nose who always was like, ah-cha-cha-cha-cha.
Yeah, it's got that style to it, yeah. Yeah, very vaudeville.
They must have really thought they hit, you know, struck gold when they watched this movie as a candidate for being one of the episodes, because it's exactly what they need. Was this a Sci-Fi Channel episode? Was this when they were doing?
No, because it's. I think it's that strange middle period of Mystery Science Theater where you have Mike now, but you still have Trace as Crow.
Right,
he hasn't left yet, and you still have the Mads, the original Mads, like with TV's Frank.
Yeah,
so it must have been like season 5 or season 6,
and that's not Sci-Fi yet.
No, it wasn't Sci-Fi till season 8.
Because this feels like the kind of movie they would have pulled out for the Sci-Fi. Because I think it sort of qualifies as...
I think in season 8, they wouldn't have been able to pull it off because the Sci-Fi Channel wanted them to do like space and...
Yeah.
And this was more fantasy. But right. I think by season 9, they had relaxed that. So it could have been a contender for like a season 9 or a season 10.
What are the other like Ren Faire one? I mean, they definitely Quest of the Delta Knights.
Quest of the Delta Knights. Yeah. That's the one I always think of. I mean, certainly the Hercules movies are basically like...
Oh, yeah, right.
Giant Ren Fest.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What's the wizard one?
Oh, there were
Merlin's
two.
Merlin's Shop of Mystical Wonders.
Oh, well, there's that. Yeah. But then that's set in like modern times and it's just Merlin is the one.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I guess that's true.
But there's like another one about wizards that I think the Netflix era did, like two of them. I think there was a sequel and they did both of them and they were really good. I hope we get to those soon.
The Legend of Boggy Creek is the monster one.
Yeah, that's a monster one. I don't know. I can't think of it right now. But there's a bunch. They probably have watched like on the order of like 10 or 15 different, just very Renfest-y, you know, style.
That's the weird thing about the Zap Rousedower one is it's like mostly a normal movie and then it's got like 10% dose of like wizards and
Ancient Temple.
Yeah.
Well, that one had such a low budget that I think they couldn't have made it into like... Because a Renfest movie requires a very minimal middle budget. Like you have to have a certain modicum of set pieces and costumes. And I think that Canadian movie was so low budget they couldn't have pulled it off, like with like costumes and stuff. That's why most of the time you're just following Zap Rousedower around in a truck in Canada and he's wearing blue jeans.
I mean, you could just go to like Vidalia, Oregon, to the Oregon Country Fair and use the backdrop as a set and then just get some like spirit Halloween costumes and you're good to go.
True. Yeah.
I mean, how much of a budget do you really need?
I don't know, man. They put all the bad guys in literally like black tank tops.
Yeah, I know.
And they're supposed to be the cult, the evil cult.
Yeah. Don't they literally pull the shirts up like over their faces at one point or something like that?
Well, they're wearing like balaclava. Not cowls, but like
Yeah.
I don't know. They're wearing like hoods, but yeah. They look like shirts with holes in them. And they're like all kind of out of shape. Like they're sort of like various levels of tubby.
Yeah.
I mean, that really is the director and his friends in the woods.
Yeah.
This one, by comparison, has a budget.
Clearly had, like a second assistant grip.
And I don't think I don't have a definitive opinion that one is better than the other. I like some of this incredibly bottom budget movies that they've watched, but I also like it when there's like a middle budget so that you can sort of, I don't know, it's a little less mean to make fun of it because you're like, oh, they could have done better with the money they had.
I mentioned this during the movie, but with movies like this one, it always blows my mind how you can clearly have professional talent doing certain things like the cinematography and then just absolutely blow it on things like some of the acting and some of the plot points and some of the pacing and like the editing choices, like amateur level mistakes in an otherwise seemingly well-constructed movie.
Yeah, it's like they had some good people involved and then a whole lot of just people who had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah. What's the line from one of the, I think it's Space Mutiny, when they're like, passed from editor to editor. Well, okay, should we get to the rating?
Yeah.
I guess it's time.
Yeah.
I guess I'll set the lower bar for you because you're undoubtedly going to give it higher than me. I think I would go as high as, I think I would go for 7. I would go as high as 7.
Wow.
I mean, I really like it, but I don't think I liked it as much as you did. I mean, I think the modern scenes that bracket the beginning and end are pretty forgettable. I don't know. You know, actually, I might go as high as, I think actually 8, and I'll go for 8 because of the skits. The movie's a 7, but the skits, you're right, Tubular Bubular Joy is like a top 3 song in the entire repertoire. It's kind of the inverse of Space Mutiny for me. You know, Space Mutiny is my favorite, but the skits are dumb. This is just like above average for me, and then the skits pull it over the top.
Oh, interesting.
The Time Machine and the Tubular Bubular Joy.
Yeah.
And what's the other skit that we really liked?
Well, there's the one at the end where they do the buffalo shots.
Yeah.
And they play some more carnival music. There's also the... because they're all dressed at one point as Fabio.
They were really... yeah, the Fabio.
They were deeply on the train of, like, buttery bodies. Like, they were just thinking about greasy nakedness. It was the whole, you know?
Yeah.
That's what that was on their brains when they were watching this movie. Uh-huh. Which you understand, because when you watch it, you're like, yeah, there's a lot of buttery bodies in this movie.
Yeah, but then it's also, like, his sidekick and the short dude. There's a lot of dumpy dump.
Oh, yeah, and they're dumpy, but they're naked. and they're oily. They're all very wet. They're like greasy.
Except Jack Palance. We never get to see him take his clothes off.
No, he's decked out in like a 3-piece wizard suit with a Pope hat. And
yeah,
he looks like he's in a different movie the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's odd because most of the time, he's not really interacting with anyone. Like he interacts with the queen.
Woman. Yeah, just the queen.
At the very end, he has like one scene with the hero and it's almost jarring. Like, because up to that point, I was like, I bet he wasn't even on set for most of this.
Well, film. I was going to say, sometimes that happens because he's worth a lot more than the other people. And so they bring him on for like literally 2 days of shooting.
Or they go somewhere to film his scene separately. Yeah. Like he doesn't fly to wherever they were.
Yeah.
He's just in Hollywood and they go over there.
Well, he must have been on some of their sets. But like, I have a feeling that it was only 2 days of shooting with him. And that's why all of the scenes are with the woman, because they just were like, we're going to shoot all the scenes with this woman.
Yeah.
And then they shoot a couple of scenes just to make it.
He also has a lot. You can tell he has very little blocking because he mostly just stands around. And I think that makes it a lot easier and shorter, like the time, because you don't have to teach them to do anything. You just like stand there and the lines will be over here and just read the lines. And it feels like he's doing that.
Yeah.
Feels like he's just staring at the camera going like, we've got to get that cabinet. You know, like you're like even the queen runs around a little bit and has like love scenes with the hero. Doesn't she try to seduce him at one point?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But Jack Palance just stands there. If you think about it, he just stands there.
I have offered the people of the Southern Sun. I always think of that's not Jack Palance, but anyway, that's the one I always think of. It's just, okay, so all I'll right, give so it an 8. I'm gonna go an 8.
Okay, well, this is gonna end up getting an average of a 9 because I have to tell you, it's a 10 for me.
Yeah,
to me, I've never had anything but joy watching this episode. Every time I've seen it, I've probably seen it more than most Mystery Science Theaters. I come back to it every time I think about like top 20. I think it's the Jack Palance, it's the tubular boobular joy, it's the inept sidekicks that randomly get swapped halfway through the film. Just them running around the desert and Whatley chasing him and going, Cabot, Cabot, Cabot. And the guys in the front going, so his name is Cabot. That. I mean, just everything, like it's so dry. Like Mike is just beautiful in this one. He's at his driest and most sarcastic. The Mads are so goofy, just over the, it's like, because it's very late Dr. Forrester and TV's Frank, and they're just so perfectly comfortable in their roles, and you can see it when they're doing the time machine stuff. It's perfect. I think it's a perfect episode of Mystery Science Theater. It's a 10 for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and you do like, see, I maybe part of it is I don't think as a genre I'm as interested in the Renaissance fair.
Wizards and Warriors
thing. Yeah. I think I like the space stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I like the shooty, shooty, bang, bang space stuff.
I think for me, it's like water in the desert. Cause like if you watch Mystery Science Theater in order, or like if you watch this live on TV for the first time, you would have probably gone through like up to 5 episodes in a row of like black and white creature features.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately they dominate the genre of Mystery Science Theater. Like there's more of those than like pretty much anything else. If there was way more space stuff, I might not be so hungry for Wizards and Warriors, but I'm just so happy to see anything that's not like, you know, Horrors of Spider Island, that I'm just like, I'm elated that it's in color. I'm elated it has a budget.
Well, I'm with you there. I just think that my tens are going to be like, you know, the goofy starship space things.
I'm also thinking of the balance of the episode though, too. Like I'm thinking a lot about the skits.
The skits are great.
I don't like that, you know, even though Space Mutiny probably has the best riffing of any Mystery Science Theater episode, I have to think about that because I really like Merlin Shop of Mystical Wonders. But top 3 riffing, it's like, it is unfortunate that I pretty much usually would fast forward through like almost all the skits.
No, it's so true.
Like I just wouldn't watch any of that Roman stuff they were doing.
I'm trying to think like, Space Mutiny is definitely not my favorite overall episode. There's no question because of that. I would say I'll have to think about it and we'll do more of these, but probably a good candidate for me actually is This Island Earth, like the one they actually turned into.
Oh, the movie. Yeah, the movie's great.
Because
spoiler alert, that one's top shelf.
Yeah, because the movie and the riffing itself rival Space Mutiny, and then the skits are some of the best they've ever done. Because, of course, they had...
Well, they were trying really hard.
They were trying really hard.
They wanted it to be really funny.
Yeah, right.
And it is.
It is great.
It's like them at their best.
Crow digging through the hall, like, I even wrote it down here.
I feel sad because it's one of those things where I know they were really stressed out making it and they were really unhappy and they talk about it now like it was the worst thing they ever did. Like, they hated making that movie.
Yeah.
But it's really great.
Right.
Like, they did a bang-up job.
Yeah.
So I think, like, you know, I definitely respond to the relaxedness of this era of Mystery Science Theater that Outlaw of Gore is set in. Like, Mike getting kind of comfortable in his role, you know, having Trace and Frank be so, like, perfect together and just have figured out their duo sidekick wacky shenanigans.
Yeah.
The relaxedness is really nice, but I also really like it when I realize like Outlaw, they're not as completely on it as they were in like This Island Earth or even like the riffing part of Space Mutiny. It's just like, it's like the golden era. Like it's the best they ever did. So I don't put it like top 5 in pure riffing. I just think in aggregate with the skits and the movie itself, it's a really good episode.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I also agree. It is an amazingly good episode. It's definitely one of those that I would put on like trying to go to sleep. Except then the problem is if I was still awake during Tubular Boobular Joy, that would probably wake me back up.
If you were like, if you had a friend and you were like, and they were like, show me Mystery Science Theater, and you weren't trying too hard to find the perfect episode, but you opened your drawer of DVDs and you saw Outlaw, you'd be like, that one's, you should just watch that one. Let's just watch that one.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. I made the mistake recently of showing my first episode of Mystery Science Theater to somebody who'd never seen it, and I showed him Space Mutiny. And I always forget that that's a bad one to pick because even though I love it, it's kind of inside baseball.
Yeah.
And the skits are terrible. Yeah. So you kind of have to either fast forward through them, which is weird, or you have to excuse them to the person and be like, yeah, these are not good.
Not good.
Outlaw of Gore would have been a better choice, but I think The Silent Earth would be the optimal way to introduce somebody just because they put in a lot more polish on it.
Yeah. Well, and they tried to make it friendly to people who didn't know the show that well.
Right. So they explain the concept inside the show. Yeah. And
I've set a man in space. Yeah. Like he literally counts it out. Like, right. This is the story of Mystery Science Theater.
Right. We should watch that one soon.
Yeah.
We should fit that.
Is it count in your rotation?
Yeah. Yeah. No,
okay.
I put it in there.
Okay. Yeah. 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 So it would come up randomly.
Yeah.
Our listeners may not know that we are usually doing a completely random. Maybe we say that.
Well, we've started to settle down a hybrid where we generate like a top five randomness and then we pick from inside that
because
we're kind of done watching the really terrible ones.
Yeah.
At least for a while.
Yeah. The KTMAs.
And then some of them just drag.
That KTMA lost episode was a little rough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was tough. Okay. So yeah, Outlaw of Gore. Any final words?
No, I think it's Criterion Collection for sure.
It's a tubular boobular joy.
Yeah, it should go in the greatest hits.
Fun for girl and boy.
It's just so good.
Okay,
so good.
All right, we'll see you in the next one.
Bye.
Day 3, missed call. Wandered into shot yesterday, and they decided to keep it.